Many people, I'm looking forward to the return of Mad Men on AMC. It's about an ad agency in Manhattan during the tumultuous 60s where office affairs are common, so is drinking and smoking on the job, and sexism is a given. Here's a scene from the last season where copy editor Peggy Olson and office manager Joan Harris are commiserating after learning that their boss, Don Draper, is marrying his secretary.
Whatever could be on your mind. Can you believe it? Happens all the time. They're all just between marriages, you know that. I'll probably make her a copywriter. He's not going to want to be married to his secretary.
Really? Is that what he meant? She admires you? Jesus.
That's the way it works for some.
You know, I just saved this company. I signed the first new business since Lucky Strike left. But it's not as important as getting married. Again.
Well, I was just made Director of Agency Operations. A title, no money, of course. And if they poured champagne, it must have been while I was pushing the mail cart.
A pretty face comes along, and everything goes out the window.
Well, I learned a long time ago to not get all my satisfaction from this job.
Our guest is Jane Maas, who worked for a real-life Madison Avenue ad agencies in the 60s and 70s. She writes about her experiences in her new book, Mad Women. She began her career as a copy editor and went on to become an executive launching the successful I Love New York campaign. She also has the dubious honor of winning the most obnoxious commercial award from the National Organization for Women twice. Jane Maas joining us by telephone. And thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for inviting me, Marty.
Well, let's begin with a question that you're always asked, but we'll get it over with, and then we'll talk
right.
about your book. And
I
also,
think I know what it's going to be.
I think
right?
you do as well. So, looking at Mad Men, fact, fiction, a mix of the two.
Well, they get a lot of things absolutely right. People say to me all the time, "Were women really discriminated against that way? Is Mad Men accurate?" About three martini lunches and all that drinking, and then they lean forward and say, was there all that sex in the office?
Exactly.
And I say the answer to all three is yes, absolutely, unequivocally, yes, there, all of that was going on.
Well, let me pick up on one of those so-called vices, and that would be smoking. You write in your book that you had your first cigarette before you go to work, before you had your first cup of coffee. How much smoking was there at Ogilvy and Mather where you worked?
Everybody smoked all the time. And then gradually, it began to be the men who were quitting, the men who were starting to heed the warnings about smoking and health. And I decided to quit when I was at a Procter & Gamble meeting, a day-long meeting in Cincinnati, and at the end of the day, I looked at the overflowing ashtray and said, my God, there was a lot of smoking going on today, and then I realized I, the only woman in the room, was also the only smoker, and I said, nope, So I ended up quitting not because of health reasons, but purely because I didn't want to be the only woman and the only smoker in this still male world.
And it sounded like you were a woman, the sole or only woman in a lot of meetings at that time.
Yes. Well, of course, women, there were a number of women copywriters at Ogilvy because we had a number of women's accounts, the kind of account that women copywriters were allowed to work on, detergents and toilet bowl cleaners, and we were not allowed to work on accounts like automobiles because men thought we didn't know how to drive, and we weren't allowed to work on anything financial because they figured we didn't know how to balance our checkbooks, and of course we couldn't work on liquor because that's what they used to seduce us, so we obviously didn't understand drinking either.
Well, speaking of liquor, and again, this is the TV show, but I also have to say, reading in your book as well, there, you know, the three martini lunch is not a piece of fiction, that there was serious drinking going on at lunchtime, and it sounds like might spill into the afternoon and certainly after work as well.
Well, one of the complaints I hear from friends in the advertising business who were active in the 60s is that Mad Men exaggerates the drinking. An account executive I knew at Ogilvy in the 60s said, "We never drank in the morning." But the three martini lunch is absolutely real. I interviewed a copywriter who had worked for me at Ogilvy, and she said that when she was at Young and Rubicam, which is supposed to be the agency on which Sterling Cooper of Mad Men is based, and Young and Rubicam was said to be the hotbed of sex in the 60s, but when she was at Young and Rubicam, her boss often took her out for lunch, and she said, "We would start with martinis. He'd have three, and I'd have two. And then we would end our lunch with rusty nails, which is a lethal combination of scotch and drambuie." And I said, "Linda, how did you get up and go back to work then?"
Exactly.
And she said, "I think what saved us is we didn't have wine."
That would have taken them over the edge, right?
Right.
But I think that's a real question, which is how do you go back to work and even function after you've had three martinis and some rusty nails?
Well, I think men went out to lunch every day. I think, as I remember it, Marty, women didn't go to lunch every day. One was we knew that somebody had to stay back in the office and get the work done. And two, I think it was a form of calorie control. We knew we couldn't just keep pouring all that amount of liquor down our throats all the time.
So does that mean the women, certainly in the afternoon, were doing the lion's share of the work?
I think so. A lot of the men, the senior men, came and took little snoozes on the couches in their office, as we see Don Draper quite often doing. And Jerry Delafamina, a famous advertising man, when I asked him the question about how did you guys go back to work, he said, "What saved us is our clients had just as much to drink at lunch as we did,
oh
and they didn't know. They didn't know we were so tipsy."
So did you do the three martini lunch, or were you more likely to stay back at work?
I was much more likely to stay back at work, and I don't mean to be goody-goody about it. I was very ambitious, and I was very eager to make my mark, and I'm only 5 feet tall, and it doesn't take much to make me a little tipsy. So I think I knew that I really couldn't do that.
Well, one of the things that is so almost shocking in Mad Men is the clothing that the women wear. The very pointed bras, looks like they've been poured into some of those very tight outfits. Bras and girdles, an occupational hazard for you back at that time?
We all had to wear layers and layers. The bras were quite painful. They bit into your shoulders and other parts of you. Remember, pantyhose had not yet been invented. We had to wear stockings with seams and little garter belts. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the next layer was a slip, which was absolutely obligatory. And then the costume that you wore to the office was either a dress, the kind that Joan wears with this very cinched-in waist and very tight bodice, or you wore a suit, the kind that Peggy very often wears with a tailored blouse. And, of course, you wore high heels all day long. If I were casting for a commercial for a housewife who was scrubbing her floor, she would scrub the floor in a skirt and blouse and
absolutely.
High heels.
Well, something that I'm sure you do every day.
Right? Absolutely. We get right out there and flop around.
We're dishing here, and your book clearly dishes on the ad world of the 60s and even into the 70s. But I also get the feeling that you really loved your job. You loved working as a copywriter and all the other jobs you've had in advertising.
Well, Marty, thank you for picking that up from the book, because I did love my job. I loved my career. Advertising was very good to me and very enriching. I think one of the things that Mad Men doesn't get is the passion that we had in that era for creating fresh, exciting new advertising, and how much we liked and respected each other, the people that we were working with. I think that was particularly true at Ogilvy and Mather, where the legendary David Ogilvy was still walking the halls in his red suspenders, and he encouraged us to be ladies and gentlemen with brains and not to pick fights with each other, not to engage in paper warfare, and to you know, just form a solid phalanx. And I think Ogilvy was very much an agency that worked very hard together for our clients and for the agency. And it was fun. It was just fun.
And do you think that was unusual at that time, or that perhaps, unlike Mad Men, it was more collaborative and cooperative?
I think it was more collaborative. There were certainly, people were ambitious. People were trying to climb the ladder to the top. But I don't think there was as much aggressiveness in pushing a fellow worker under the bus as there is in Mad Men. But I keep reminding myself, Mad Men is a drama, and they need to have a certain amount of tension going on. So,
well, let me ask you about David Ogilvy, and he was obviously one of the founders of where you worked, Ogilvy and Mather. One of the things that he said, though, was that the consumer is not a moron. The moron is your wife. Was he joking? What did he mean by that?
He said, Marty, actually, he said the consumer is not a moron. She is your wife, meaning the consumer is not a moron, right? I think he has been often misquoted on that. However, even though he firmly believed that and believed that we should treat women consumers as people with brains and minds, he did say he firmly believed that if two people at Ogilvy got married, one of them had to leave. It was a very, very firm rule and was acted on all the time. In fact, in his book, Confessions of an Advertising Man, right, he wrote, one of them has to leave, preferably the woman, to stay home and take care of her babies. And it took years for his partners to convince him to delete that from the copies of his book, because obviously women didn't like that at all.
Indeed, and we're almost up in a break here, but you were a working woman at this time. Did other women look down on you, do you think?
Well, a woman with children under the age of 12 simply did not work in those days. When my older daughter was in first grade, there were only two full-time working mothers. The other women thought we were a little weird and would say to us, what do you do when they're sick? You know, with some disdain. And men, of course, pitied us because they figured we had to be married to bums. Otherwise, why were we working? It just simply wasn't done.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Jane Moss, and I should spell her last name since part of my last name is Moss. Her last name is spelled M-A-A-S, and she worked for a Madison Avenue firm back in the 60s and 70s, first as a copywriter, then as a creative director. She went on to head up her own ad agency, and she's written a book, a memoir called Mad Women, and we're taking a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies supports WHYY. Penn's Master of Liberal Arts program allows students to combine graduate-level classes into a single master's degree built around what matters to them. Their interdisciplinary curriculum includes seminars that offer new perspectives on subjects that interest the student. Instructors and peers in creative writing workshops share experiences as writers that can help students hone their craft. Details on how to pursue your passion for writing at Penn online by searching Penn MLA.
The Discover Newsworks Discover the Philadelphia Region sweepstakes. Newsworks.org is giving away great prizes to our Facebook fans. This week, 6 tickets to 1812 Productions, Philly's all-comedy theater company. Search Newsworks.org on Facebook and enter weekly. Share with your friends for extra chances to win. You must like Newsworks.org on Facebook to enter. No purchase necessary. For a complete list of rules, go to Newsworks.org. Newsworks.org, powered by WHYY and you. Smart. Local. News.
St. Patrick's Day comes early this year. Patty Maloney and the Chieftains return to the Kimmel Center for one show only on Friday, March 9th. Celebrating their 50th anniversary, the Chieftains are beloved for bringing traditional Irish music to the world stage. This Philadelphia favorite returns to the Kimmel Center for a rollicking pre-St. Patrick's Day bash. Tickets for the Chieftains are available at 215-893-1999 or KimmelCenter.org. The Kimmel Center supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When people hear that Jane Moss worked for an ad agency back in the 1960s, they inevitably ask if the TV show Mad Men gets it right, the booze, the sex, the sexism. Her answer is yes and no, and she's written about her own experiences in a book called Mad Women, The Other Side of Life on Madison Avenue in the 60s and Beyond. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY. Jane, you ask you say something that I thought was pretty bold, and you talk about being a working mother and wife in the 60s, and this is how you prioritized your world. Your job came first, your husband came a close second, and the children came third. And I have to say, I wrote that down because I thought that was a pretty bold thing to say. How did your children feel about that?
Well, my older daughter, I'm afraid, feels that to this day, she feels that I simply wasn't there for her a lot of times when I needed her. My younger daughter, 4 years younger, remembers that her friends in school thought I was the living end. I was, she says, Mom, my friends thought you were so cool. You were the mother they wished their mothers would be. So there I have two very different sides of it. I feel guilty about not being there for my older daughter, but if I had to do it over again, Marty, I'd do exactly the same thing. I really, really needed to work, not financially, I needed to work for me, emotionally, and I knew that my husband needed to have a lot of my time and support and love, and my priorities had to be set, and that's the way I set them.
Well, and I don't think you're alone in that. In these days, it's not just women that work, but which is trying to balance all these responsibilities and to figure out who and what comes first. Is this something, I'm just curious, with your older daughter, is this something that you and she have been able to talk about?
Yes, happily, we have been able to talk about it, and we have become closer and closer and closer friends. She, I have a granddaughter, her little girl, who's 11, and I see a lot of her, and so I think we've patched things up.
And looking back at that time, do you feel that you were part of the feminist movement? What did it feel like, a feminist statement on your part?
No, I didn't really feel it was a feminist statement at all. The fact that I was career first and husband second and children third, I felt that was just what I had to do, as opposed to being part of a movement. You know, Marty, you're bringing up this whole thing about working moms.
Yes.
I think one of the important spines of this book, in addition to all the fun and games and talk about sex and booze and stuff, which reflects the times, is when I interviewed women who had been working moms in the 60s, I heard over and over and over again, Jane, I wasn't a very good mother, and I wasn't a very good wife, and I wasn't very good at my career because I was so torn that I didn't do anything as well as I should have. And then when I began to interview working moms today, I heard exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And it was almost eerie to hear the same words coming from young women who have work full-time jobs and children and husbands.
Well, and Betty Friedan, you know, talked about the problem that had no name. Maybe today there's more of a name for that the being pulled in so many different directions.
Well, I talked to some, after I began to realize this phenomenon was happening, I talked to some psychologists and some educators, and their feeling is that women are wired differently, just biologically, that maternal instinct is very strong. A man will throw money at the problem, they said. A man will say, hire a housekeeper, hire two housekeepers if you have to, and a woman will say, I want to raise my own children. I want to look after my own home and not delegate it quite so much.
And you said you had to work. I mean, you just felt like psychologically, for your own psychological health, you needed to be at the office?
Absolutely, I did. Terribly, terribly needed to be, to have something that made me feel like a person and just being a mom. Mm-hmm. This sounds terrible to me. I'm hearing myself say this, Marty, but I'm sure there are a lot of women who feel this way. I just really loved having a career, and it was terribly important to me.
Well, let me go back to some of the, and I appreciate your honesty about it, frankly, because I think it's a struggle for many people, and not everyone is willing to prioritize as you have. But let me go back to, and not just Mad Men, but also in your book, you talk about the office affairs. Clearly in the TV show, we see many office affairs, and I got the feeling from your book that it was relatively common to have office affairs.
Well, the people said in the 60s that sex was in the air. People breathed it, I was told, when I began to interview people for the book. I think part of it was the pill had just been was just made available in 1960, and that probably increased the freedom of people to have sex. The women's movement and feminism was beginning to take hold, particularly among creative people. And also, we were all working very, very hard, and when you're thrown together, and people were thrown together a lot, and the most senior men who were giving their lives, really, to the agencies they worked for, and they were the ones who were there early in the morning and stayed until late at night, and by the time they got home, their wives were asleep, and so it was very, very tempting for them, I think, to begin to have affairs, romances with the sweet young things, the attractive young, sexy young women at the office.
Well, you even say, and I guess with a senior executive, they could afford to have an apartment in the city, and if they were working long hours or even a hotel room in the city, that was a place where they could go.
You bet. And here's another thing. They had offices with doors that locked, and they had couches. The younger account executives weren't allowed to have couches. They only had chairs. When you got promoted to vice president as a mark of your promotion at Ogilvy, you got a couch.
And where you worked, did everyone know who was having an affair with somebody else and you just looked the other way?
Most of the time, everybody knew sooner or later, but everyone was very discreet. Mm. I was told by some of the folks at Young and Rubicam that there was a hotel right around the corner, and the desk clerks didn't bat an eye or raise their eyebrows if you asked for a key at 12 noon and returned it at 2. And they said, and if you met fellow agency people in the lobby as you were coming out, you just averted your eyes and didn't say hello.
You also tell a story about, I guess, an office where there was some sexual activity going on, and the door was open.
There was no door, I think.
Or there was no door. What?
The couple thought that they were alone, except the big boss was, he was an account executive, and she was a secretary, and they were having a little sex in the office, and the boss, on his way out, discovered them, and the upshot was that he was given a promotion and an office with a door, and the secretary was fired. Mm. And that's what very often happened, that somebody had to be punished as far as the agency was concerned if the sex were blatant, and It was usually the woman.
And as someone that worked in those kinds of offices in those days, was that just a given, or did people feel as if that was unfair? And, you know, why was he promoted and she was kicked out the door?
Well, Marty, I think, unfortunately, a lot of women accepted this accepted it as a given. That's the way things were. That was the status quo. A woman copywriter told me that she went to her boss and complained that the copywriter sitting in the next office to her was making twice what she was. And she said, "I think I'm writing just as good advertising and probably better, and I would like to make as much as he's making." And her boss said, but he's a man. He has a wife and kids to support." And she said, I didn't think of that." Well, and dropped the matter and didn't bring it up again.
It sounds a lot like Peggy Olson.
Well, yes, I think she has been very accepting of a lot of demeaning stuff.
And that's Jane Moss, our guest today on Radio Time. She began her career in advertising at Ogilvy and Mather as a copywriter. This was back in the 1960s. Eventually became a creative director and agency officer. She also became the president of a New York ad agency, best known for her work on the I Love New York campaign. And she's written about her various adventures as a young woman working in the world of advertising. The book is called Mad Women, The Other Side of Life on Madison Avenue in the 60s and beyond. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And just to continue our conversation talking about office affairs, you also talk about, and I'm quoting here, "No virgin returned a virgin on the Ogilvy boat ride."
Well, that was a famous boat ride to which the entire agency was invited. It was a boat ride around Manhattan Island, and it was because you were sort of trapped out there on the rivers. It was kind of an orgy of drinking and a lot of sexual activity. And one year, our office manager got so drank so much that he fell overboard as we were coming into dock, and he was fished out none the worse for wear. But then David Ogilvy decided no more boat rides.
The end of the boat rides. But it also sounds that part of somebody's job was to find a date, quote unquote, for clients. I mean, the idea of what, using sexual favors for clients?
Yes, well, that was pretty common. It never happened to me, but a woman friend of mine who was an account executive said her client from out of town had called her and asked her to arrange for what the client referred to as a special friend. An account executive, now quite a distinguished client of mine, told me that when he was a young, wet behind the ears new account executive, his out-of-town client called and asked him to arrange a date. And Don said that he was newly married, but he'd look up some old girlfriends. And the client said, "No, I mean a date." And Don said I could hear the italics in his voice. And so a friend told him to buy Screw magazine and check on some of the classified ads that the hookers put in, and that's what he did. And he called several of them and made careful notes about their conversations, and he said he jotted little notes in the margin of Screw and circled some of the names and said, "Sounds promising, a little rough around the edges, etc. And he actually paid a visit to one of these ladies to make sure that she looked okay. He paid her in advance on behalf of the client, called the client. Everything was set up. Client called him the next day and said, "It was just fine. Thank you very much." And Don said he considered the case closed. The matter was over. And about a week later, he said to his new bride, "Oh, by the way, my paycheck's right there in my briefcase. You can just go get it out." And he hears a shriek from the bedroom because she has opened the briefcase and discovered the copy of Screw magazine with all the hookers, advertisements circled with his comments. And so he said, to this day, I don't know whether she actually believed that I was doing it for a client or whether she just forgave me.
And
after.
Are they still together, those
they're
two?
They're still together.
In spite of that question mark over that particular adventure. You know, Jane, you, back in 1986, you wrote a book called Adventures of an Advertising Woman. And you say in this new book, Mad Women, that was a whitewash. It was actually written to attract clients.
Yes. At that point, I was president of a New York agency called Muller, Jordan Weiss, and David Ogilvy, when he wrote Confessions of an Advertising Man, had managed to get a lot of attention and lure in a lot of clients. And I thought, well, I'll write Adventures of an Advertising Woman. And so I, of course, wanted to paint a good picture of the agency. So no cloud is in the sky over Madison Avenue, and all clients are smart, and all of our advertising is successful. So it was very much whitewashed.
And this book, a corrective on the world of advertising?
I think so. As you said just a few minutes ago, that you thought I was being very honest, and I think I was in some respects painfully honest in this book. I talked about a creative director who sexually harassed me for about 2 years, and I finally went to a psychiatrist. And he said, well, tell him you're happily married and you don't want to have an affair. And I just sighed and thought, you know, it's not as easy as that. It's not as easy as that.
And there was no HR department in your corner either.
That was the only HR department was the office manager who had fallen overboard. And I didn't think he was going to be much help. I couldn't tell my husband, a former Marine officer. He would have come in and shot the bastard.
Oh,
so
wow.
That wouldn't have done anything.
So how did this end, or that?
It ended that I went. I did what was considered a big no-no, which was to go to David Ogilvy. I didn't tell him about the harassment, but I went to David and asked him if I could be assigned to a different creative group, to a different creative director. And I thought it would be very helpful to me to learn new creative style. And then I began to cry. And he pretended, bless his heart, he pretended that he wasn't aware that I was crying. And he said, my dear girl, you have every reason to be transferred, and I will make it happen. And in 3 days, I was assigned to a different group.
And do you think the fact that there was so much sex at the office opened the door to sexism and even sexual harassment?
Yes, I think so. And part of it was because women were so passive about it, as you said, Peggy is on Mad Men. I think it was a good decade before women began to start bristling. And 20 years before Anita Hill, and the term sexual harassment became widely used.
I'm curious about the response to your book from the world of advertising. Has there been a response that you've been aware of?
Yes, I think people are very, very eager to read it, and I think I'm getting a lot of agreement that the show doesn't reflect the fun we had, the passion we had for advertising, and how young the world of advertising was, and how fresh and new, because the creative revolution was going on with things like Volkswagen's Lemon and Avis's Only Number 2. It was unheard of in those days to say your product, your brand is number 2. You never did that. So we were carving out new territory. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I went to work for Mary Wells, who had painted the Braniff Plains in all those colors, and that was I Love New York. So that continued a wonderful career.
Well, we'll continue with that after this short break. Jane Maas, our guest today in Radio Times, author of a new book called Mad Women, The Other Side of Life on Madison Avenue in the 60s and Beyond, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital supports WHYY and serves the entire Delaware Valley community, tackling problems that include high blood pressure, irregular heart rhythms, blocked arteries, and heart failure. Their Women's Heart Health website offers advice from the physicians at Jefferson Heart Institute on heart risk factors, working with your doctor, steps for healthier living, and more at jeffersonhospital.org/womenheart. Thomas Jefferson University Hospital.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Google has a new privacy policy. What do users need to know? Also, President Obama hosts a state dinner for a handful of Iraq war vets, but one of the invitees asks, what about something more? We'll get into the debate over having a parade for Iraq war veterans. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Nick Flynn was working at a homeless shelter when his father, an alcoholic and self-proclaimed writer Flynn never knew as a child, showed up as a client. Flynn wrote about it in his 2004 memoir. Now it's a film starring Robert De Niro as Flynn's father, directed by Paul Weitz, who also directed About a Boy. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Nick Flynn and Paul Weitz. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Jane Moss about her early years in the world of advertising on Madison Avenue. She's written about her experiences in a book called Mad Women, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Jane, let me get a couple of callers in, and then we'll go back to your life. And we have, looks like, Heather from Downingtown joining us on Radio Times. And Heather, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much. And sure. Thanks so much for having such a great guest. This is awesome.
Thanks.
My question is, you know, having been a trailblazer in a male-dominated industry, what are your thoughts about women kind of backing out and dropping out, if you will, to stay at home and take on more traditional roles? And I can take my answer off air. And thank you again.
Thank you, Heather, for calling in. Jane, do you have opinions about that?
That if a woman wants to quit work and stay home with her children, that is certainly her decision, just as it was mine not to stay home with my children. And I respect that and admire it. And I think we've got to stop the kind of war between women that is happening, where women who are working kind of look down at the women who are stay-at-home moms, and some of the stay-at-home moms, I think, wonder how working moms can be good mothers.
Mm.
I think women need to support each other better than we have been.
Thanks for the call. Let me see what Michelle from Harleysville has to say. Michelle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have two comments.
Sure.
I think you had said something earlier about how it sounded terrible that you needed psychologically to be more than a mom. And I think it's interesting that that's not a comment that we hear from men. And I'm a working mother, and I work in a predominantly male field.
Yep.
And one of the comments that one of the males that I work with, whose wife is a stay-at-home mom, he referred to his wife as a full-time mom, and the other young woman that I work with in the office, who's also a working mother, he referred to us as part-time moms. So luckily I have a very supportive husband and children, and
good,
they don't see me as being just a part-time mom and see me devoted fully to both. But I just wanted to make those comments. This has been a very interesting program. Thank you, and all.
Thank you, Michelle. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Jane, you want to add to that?
I just thought that was a wonderful comment, and she obviously feels that she is being both a full-time working mother and both a full-time career person and a full-time mom, and I didn't hear any guilt in that lovely comment.
And thanks for calling into Radio Times. You've talked a lot about David Ogilvy, and it sounds like he was a really good boss to you, Jane Moss. A completely different story with Leona Helmsley, and you said working, I guess, with her, for her, were the worst, 7 months of your life?
Yes, seven terrible, terrible months. Leona, of course, was known as the Queen of Mean. She was ended up in jail for tax fraud. But I tell people, don't believe everything that you hear about Leona. She was worse than that.
Oh, wow.
She was, if I presented an ad to her that she didn't like, she would drop it on the floor and stamp on it.
And I'd say, gee, Leona, I guess you don't like that ad. But she did one good thing for me. She taught me to have a thicker skin and to be a little bit tougher, and that probably stood me in good stead.
Well, even early on in your working relationship with her, she didn't like your hair or your clothes, and perhaps that was a sign that this wasn't going to work out very well, and took you to have you fixed.
Well, yes, she thought my hair was too red, so she had me change into a blonde, and she didn't like the way I dressed. She thought it was too tailored, too kind of Peggy Olson, I guess, and she wanted to turn me more into a Joan. And so she took me to her dressmaker and had a lot of dresses made for me. She didn't pay for the dresses, Marty. She just insisted that I go to the dressmaker and have all these kind of frilly dresses made.
And so she lived up or down to her reputation.
She certainly did. I was sitting at Four Seasons restaurant while she was in jail, and the telephone rang, and one of the owners had a conversation, and I could see him blanch. I could see his eyes just go wide, and it was Leona Helmsley calling from the Danbury Women's Prison to order a birthday cake for one of the inmates. And he said, yes, Mrs. Helmsley, yes, Mrs. Helmsley, we'll get it right to you.
Oh, my goodness.
So she was still manipulating people. She took me to Saks Fifth Avenue to buy a pair of shoes because she didn't like the shoes I had. Again, she didn't buy the shoes, I did. But she said to the clerk, how much are those shoes? And he said, they're $150, ma'am. And she said, I'll give you $75. And he said, excuse me, this is Saks Fifth Avenue. And she said, do you know who I am?
Oh,
I am Leona Helmsley. Get your manager. She ended up, I paid $75 for the shoes.
I bet you did. That does not surprise me.
Nope. She was a bully.
Well, let me shift gears here. As much as I'd love to stay in talking and gossiping about Leona Helmsley, but let me talk about the Dove account that you had. And I actually want to play a Dove commercial that you put together. Let's listen to this.
Dishwashing liquid that thinks it's a hand lotion. You're Dove for dishes, remember? And you belong in the kitchen. Oh, I know. Washing dishes made my hands real dry. And then you came along and undried them. Oh, no.
Dove for dishes, the dishwashing liquid that thinks it's a hand lotion. Got dry hands? Undry them with Dove.
And Jane Moss of the National Organization for
Women. I haven't heard that commercial in a long time.
In a long time. Well, it was buried somewhere, but we found it, and the National Organization for Women called this the most obnoxious commercial. How does that, I know we're listening to it, obviously, but how does it sound to you today?
It sounds a little old to me. It sounds a little hard sell, and I don't think I would write it that way today. But remember that in advertising, we had a copy strategy to follow, and Dove for Dishes' whole reason for existence was to keep a woman's hand soft and smooth. So that was a point that, as a copywriter, I needed to make, and that was why the National Organization for Women considered it obnoxious and asked me why I didn't have a man doing the dishes every once in a while.
Right.
And that would not have been, that would have been absolutely off the positioning and off the strategy. You don't want a man's hands to be soft and smooth. I mean, at least a man usually doesn't.
Right, right. And that's obviously the difference between the sort of political and the commercial look at a particular product. Was this, did you have this Dove account because it was considered a female account?
Yes.
It wasn't cars, as you said, or finance because women couldn't do those things.
When I was the first woman assigned to the American Express card account, and the account executives who took me down said the folks at American Express might be kind of unsure about having a woman, and so maybe they'd be a little hostile. Mm-hmm. But when we got there, the big boss pulled out a chair and said, "So glad to have you, dear." And I thought, well, this isn't going to be so bad. And then he said to me, did you forget your steno pad, dear? He thought I was a secretary who would come to take notes on the meeting. So.
Of course. let me get, looks like Barbara from Chichester in on our conversation. And Barbara, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going all the way back to the beginning, and it occurred to me that the speaker might be a little too hard on herself in saying that she put her career first. As I see it, really, she was putting herself first, and her love for advertising was what fed her, just as though a stay-at-home mom might put volunteering first or put their hobby first. And so isn't that really saying that we're doing the same thing as men in seeing that as part of our whole?
Fair enough. Barbara, thanks for the call. Jane Moss, go ahead.
Well, that was a very nice and understanding comment. And Barbara, thank you. That's my only comment on the comment, is that it was very, very generous, and I think that's right. I do a lot of speaking on college campuses, and the first question I still hear from young women is, how am I going to handle a marriage and motherhood and a career? And somebody said to me, when was the last time you heard a man stand up and ask that question? I don't think men worry about how they're going to juggle those three things.
Barbara, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You had mentioned the Lemon ad and the Avis ad. You know, we're number two. And it seems that you worked in the advertising business when it was going through some pretty dramatic changes and becoming, you know, the idea of thinking small, for instance, with the Volkswagen ad, which is sort of clever and I'm assuming kind of counterintuitive in the world of advertising back then.
Oh, well, Detroit was all about big cars. And so along comes this little agency, Doyle Dane Burnback, and they say, think small. And that was the first gun in the revolution, as was the ad called Lemon, where they showed a photograph of the Volkswagen and with the headline Lemon, admitting that every once in a while a car came down the production line that had to be junked because it wasn't good enough. And all of these things were just unheard of. You never treated a brand like that. You never said anything at all negative about it. And it was people sat up and began to take notice. So there was a lot of ferment in advertising. That's when a lot of the new, young, hot boutiques sprang up. Mary Wells Lawrence started her own agency in the late 60s or early 70s, probably late 60s. Mm-hmm. And because clients suddenly looked around and said, oh, I want to have a hot boutique that's doing all this new advertising, and there weren't enough to go around, and so they were being opened up like one a week. Somebody would hang out his shingle.
And I remember from one of the episodes in Mad Men, Don Draper is looking at one of these kinds of ads that you're describing, and he says, I don't know what I hate about it most. And then he goes on to say, but we've been talking about it for an hour.
Yes. I think that's a wonderfully telling comment, but we've been talking about it for an hour.
Right.
It really caught the attention of everybody in the advertising business.
Now, you helped to spearhead or launch or even created this I Love New York campaign. Was that something that came to you? Because in hindsight, it seemed it's so simple and declarative and fits on a T-shirt really nicely. What was the thinking behind that?
The thinking behind that came out of research that said that New York State was very, very much loved, and that people were coming from all sorts of other states to New York. And so another copywriter, not I, wrote, I'm from New Hampshire, but I love New York. I'm from Pennsylvania, but I love New York. And then when the great genius Milton Glaser designed that logo, that I Heart NY logo, he picked up on I Love New York. And the man who wrote the music picked up on I Love New York. And so there were a lot of fathers of this I Love New York, but I can sit here and tell you I am its only mother.
good for you, Jay Moss. Let me see what Katie from West Philadelphia has to say. And Katie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me here, and thanks for having such a wonderful discussion.
Oh, thanks.
One of the things that really strikes me about Mad Men is how some of the powerful women, particularly Joan, really use their sexuality almost as a weapon. And I was wondering if you could speak to whether or not you thought that was something that was true in your experience.
Katie, thanks for the call. Jane Moss, can you do that?
I think some women did indeed use sexuality. A woman who worked for me as a secretary and wanted to become a copywriter actually moved to a different agency and went to work for the vice chairman. And she was indeed promoted to being a copywriter and ultimately married the vice chairman. And I asked her when I interviewed her for the book, was there much sex in the office? And she said, how do you think I got Joe?
Goodness gracious. You also said, I think you and somebody else said, sex may make the world go round, but it doesn't sell products. Do you want to take those words back, Jane Moss?
Yes, I'm absolutely willing to eat crow about those words because I think we have now seen sex sell everything from shaving cream to Mack trucks.
Yes, somehow it seems to work. You also worked on a show, and this is going to date both of us, called Name That Tune.
Yes.
What was your job?
I interviewed the contestants and wrote their spontaneous dialogue with the master of ceremonies and then rehearsed them to make sure that they got their lines right. These were not the questions and answers. This was the chit-chat before the actual, questions began. But that experience of interviewing hundreds of contestants over a couple of years really helped me very much as a copywriter because I kind of knew how Americans talked.
And final question, about 45 seconds here, but when you look at an ad on television, can you not critique it?
It's impossible for me not to critique it one way or the other. I say, what are they saying to me? I don't get it. Or I say, oh, that's really smart, or whatever I say. But yes, I'm a built-in critic.
And do you miss advertising, working?
I'm still working.
Are you still working?
Yes.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Jane Moss. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Marty, thank you for having read the book so wonderfully, carefully.
Well, you're very welcome. It's part of my job, and it's a part of, frankly, what makes my job fun. And Jane Moss's book is called Mad Women, The Other Side of Life on Madison Avenue in the 1960s and Beyond. Joined us on Radio Times and Mad Men returning the end of March. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder with Jonathan Best. I'm Marty Moscoen. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.